1. And this is coming, and it's possible, and it's now. And thank you very much. So because of the constraints of time and so forth, we decided we'll go right into a Q&A that we'll do for a little while. So, and I guess they've set up microphones down here. So if anyone wants to ask a question, and Lord knows, I hope someone does, come down to the microphone and we'll work through it. Try not to trample each other. Thank you very much, by the way, for your response. This stuff is mighty peculiar. I want you to know I think so, too. I haven't grown blasé. Yeah.
Whew, you get better, Terrence.
Thank you. It's nice of you to say so.
I've just been really impressed lately with more and more stuff I've been hearing about cannabis hemp, and maybe that could be the trans-time way of aesthetically bringing about this loving, you know, revolution that you seem to be describing.
Is that a question?
Well,
I can treat it as a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, in this book that I wrote, Food of the Gods, which I guess is on sale back there somewhere, I talk about drugs as cultural clothing. And how every culture, the pattern seems to be, every culture selects two or three drugs to be its favorites and then furiously inveighs against everything else as just, the curse of Satan. Cannabis is a particularly interesting case because I think most intelligent people, and certainly anyone who studies these things, would agree with my statement that of the major intoxicants known to mankind, surely cannabis must be the most benign. And yet, it is incredibly stigmatized by the establishment. And I think this is entirely because it promotes this kind of boundary-dissolving awareness that I'm talking about. The psychedelics are not an addiction problem. They are not the root of some crime problem that is overwhelming society. The only problem with psychedelics is that they empower people to ask questions. And that which was supposed to be the whole purpose of the American Union, to create a society of free men and women, has in fact become very frightening to the establishment. For example, contrast caffeine and cannabis. Caffeine, it's well known, causes liver cancer. There may be a relationship to heart disease, so forth and so on. It is not the scourge of the earth. On the other hand, it is not the most clean and safe drug around, and many people abuse it. Yet it is written into every labor contract signed between management and labor in the entire Western world as the coffee break. Now, why is that? It's because human beings, having been jacked up on caffeine, willfully return to the keyboard and the assembly line, and the last 3 hours of the eight-hour day that is enshrined in the capitalist ideal is made possible by caffeine. Cannabis, on the other hand, more money has been spent to find something wrong with cannabis than on any other drug in the pharmacopoeia. And, you know, There's nothing there, folks. I mean, there is nothing that you can hold up with certainty. And so why is it stigmatized and caffeine is not? Because it makes people uninterested in working on the assembly line, interested in long animated conversations, interested in exploring new ways of looking at things. And this is just anathema. The drugs which are dangerous to society are sugar, alcohol, and tobacco, the ones which are freely peddled on every street corner in the Western world. The social consequences, if every alcoholic were a pothead, if every tobacco smoker were a pot smoker, the social consequences for society would be very, very positive. The number of hospitalizations, violent crimes, so forth and so on, would decline dramatically. We are not rational in our attitude towards these things. Drugs which empower self-reflection and community are being suppressed. Drugs which permit enslavement, either through addiction or to capitalist styles of time expenditure, are promoted, advertised, glorified. This is unconscionable. I mean, I don't want to say any more about it. I've got a long line. But
I was actually sort of hoping you'd also comment on the capitalistic potential, because, I mean, this could, like, be the safe form of capitalism is, you know, give these entrepreneurs bags of hemp seeds and let them make 10,000 different, you know, luxury
well,
products.
Well, I'm all
you know.
For that, yeah. I think that the potential of the hemp plant has been deliberately downplayed and distorted because nobody knew what to do about its potential as an intoxicant. I think the whole thing is a disgrace. It's been manipulated and it's been misrepresented, and it's a wonderful thing that these hemp people are coming forward and doing something about it.
So you're saying that capitalism might not have to die because we have hemp? Or?
Well, capitalism is going to have to severely modify itself. I'm not anti-capitalist in the sense that I don't think anybody should make a profit. I'm anti-capitalist in the sense that I don't think people should make a living dealing unnecessary junk to people who have been saturated with advertising designed by fiends to distort their judgment. Yeah.
This is a question about the great attractor or something you called that.
Good, good.
Did you ever see that movie 2001?
A couple of times. So.
Could the great attractor be symbolized in that movie by the monolith?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the myth of what I'm saying. If instead of having those monkeys jumping around in front of a slab of linoleum, they had had them cavorting in the presence of a mushroom, then you would have pretty much had my theory in a nutshell.
Could part of the great attractor also be black holes in space? Like a connection between the monolith or the mushroom and star systems, and we're getting pulled that way.
The connection is that a black hole represents a singularity in physics. And what is a singularity? A singularity is a place where the rules don't apply. As an aside, let me point out that, remember how I said science said, grant us one miracle and we can explain everything? Well, but then out of the theory of relativity, you get black holes. Well, if you talk to a physicist, they will tell you that at the center of every black hole, there is a singularity, meaning a place where the laws of physics break down. Well, so then you say to these astrophysicists, well, how many black holes are there in the universe? Say, well, probably 10 high 11. Say, I see. So it isn't that you wanted one miracle, it's that you want 10 high 11 exceptions to your physics, and you call that a coherent theory of space and time? It's more shot through with exceptions than anything I can imagine. So I think it's by analogy. There are stranger things in this universe than physical black holes. There are also the hyperdimensional wells into which mental constructs evolve, And the black hole operates as a kind of analogy to that process, or it's the same thing in a different octave.
Do you travel into those dimensions when you do psychedelics?
You do, but the trick is to bring something back, because...
Like your body?
Pardon me?
Like your body?
Well, okay.
Bridge and,
about what?
The Hudson Bridge and... I was wondering if you could comment in honor of the elections that are coming up about the word democracy that you were talking about and the Orwellian misuse of this. And you mentioned a very interesting concept about how democracy can't exist with materialism. And I was hoping you could elaborate on that. I thought it might be useful to some people.
Well, I didn't mean to sound undemocratic. As I was saying it, I realized there was ambiguity there. I am a democrat through and through. To me, it isn't a form of government. It's an aspect of biology. I mean, of course, one person, one vote. Any other scheme seems wildly artificial in the face of that. But you see, democracy, as Jefferson and John Stuart Mill envisioned it, they couldn't conceive of Madison Avenue, the invasive penetration of media, and this sort of thing. And we pretend we have a democracy, but the population that votes is so assaulted by lies and spectacularly manipulated special effects that to pretend that people are making informed decisions based on a careful and rational assessment of the issues is an absurd fiction. So somehow, if we want to preserve democracy, I think we're going to have to seriously consider how to deal with modern technology's ability to rig the election. You know, Plato, who we all give lip service to, was very suspicious of what he called the poets. He didn't think that everybody should be allowed to run around saying anything they wanted. Freedom of speech in the minds of the founding fathers meant freedom of political speech. And I think political speech should be protected, but speech for the purpose of peddling flawed merchandise or, you know, cracked brain ideologies of various sorts, is speech which is inimical to the common good should not claim the same protections as political speech. Right now in Switzerland, it's very interesting, there's a national debate raging about the limiting of advertising. This is the only country in the Western world that I know of that is actually confronted the fact that advertising does not make free choice easier. It's an effort to make it impossible. And I think, you know, somewhere along the line in the unfolding of the new social agenda, we're going to have to consider the possibility that speech which is harmful to the public good needs to be regulated in some way. I mean, this is a complicated matter, but it should be looked at.
And how does how is democracy inhibited by the pursuit of materialism or the materialistic
The reason I say capitalism and democracy are at loggerheads is because these are two separate theories of human worth. Democracy says one person, one vote. Capitalism says you are what you have. And these are completely different theories of human worth, and I don't see how we can pretend that they're commiserate. Yeah.
Thank you. If there ever was, or if there is any need on this planet, in America, for legislators, Congress members, city council members, presidents, and I expect there is. I certainly would like to say that people with your consciousness and people with the consciousness in this room should be in those positions today. We'd have a much, much better planet.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure you're right. I would like to figure out some way to make democracy ever more representative. Let me say, I mean, just in the interest of general perverseness, the thing which fascinated me about Perot was the idea of an electronic town meeting is an incredibly subversive idea from the point of view of any governing establishment. I mean, that was, to the establishment, the equivalent of advocating the legalization of LSD. Anything which gives people more direct control of their institutions is looked on with immense suspicion by the establishment. They want representative government, which means that we, the unwashed masses, are expected to choose wise and wealthy white men from among our numbers, and then they will interpret what is good for us and vote for that kind of legislation. I think that the idea of everybody inputting into societal decisions through electronic media is an incredibly radical idea, and not one that any establishment politician of either of the major parties can ever be expected to support or get behind, because that pulls the rug out from under their game.
I would expect there's, even with all the similarities, there's much diversity even in this room. I feel there's a popular bumper sticker. It says, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. I think we can make a difference. And I think it's real important to link the political and the spiritual. I think there's never been a real massively oriented spiritual presence in any election campaign that I've ever seen. And I think the time is right now to save this planet. I think we need to do that, that we need to go forward in this room and get involved in the campaigns of people that we know are going to make a difference.
Yeah, and I agree.
The most spiritual statement I can close by saying right now is that this planet cannot tolerate another 4 years of George Bush and Dan Quayle. Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing.
Okay. Your speech was very reminiscent of a lot of millenarianism in other religions. In your opinion, this transformation, necessary transformation, will it be a sort of a threshold scenario, or will it be gradual?
Well, it is happening, but it's happening ever faster, and it's a kind of asymptotic acceleration. I mean, I think that if I'm right, by the year 2000, a major item of public discourse will be the accelerating dissolution of boundaries. I don't know how much longer they can maintain the fiction of business as usual, because it's getting harder and harder to maintain that something very, very bizarre isn't happening to us. They still talk about business as usual.
Should I say this? Well, why not?
It will be very interesting to see how Mr. Clinton does if he's elected president. I suspect that what he exists for is to prove that switching from Republican to Democrat is nowhere near a radical enough transition to make a significant difference in our problems. That once we move people of goodwill, and I grant that to those people, once we move people of goodwill into positions of management and discover we still cannot halt the processes that are underway, then we'll be ready for a serious dialogue about serious change.
I perceived a paradoxical kind of kink in your lecture, and I thought maybe you could address that. It was when, first of all, you were talking about the hubris of modern Western man, of considering that we could make up models for how to perceive of the universe,
And then later on you said that a certain nihilism starts to exist when we have, when we consider death to be just bleak nothingness. But doesn't the same thing, the same kind of nihilism tend to exist when you have the same kind of, you know, considering, if we don't consider ourselves rational beings, then don't you start getting the same kind of nihilism, and wouldn't that result in the same problem? And you kind of implicitly addressed that when you started just making your own model of the universe in the kind of way that you claim Western civilization was doing. You started making up your own model and your own scenario.
Well, I think that models exist for navigational purposes, not for metaphysical purposes. In other words, you need a model to get through daily life, but you should never confuse the model with reality. This is what I was referring to when I talked about how you have to accept the absence of closure. If you, it's too technical to get into here, but something like Gödel's incommensurability theorem proves that you can never generate all possible true statements out of a formal system. There is always going to be a residuum of the unknowable and the mysterious. And I think that's the part of the process that lets you know that you're a thinking monkey. So I don't see how nihilism is necessarily a consequence of that. You have to embrace the mystery, and unfortunately the male dominator mentality feels threatened by the mystery, and so it keeps trying to squeeze it out. But to the degree that it does that, it betrays the descriptive enterprise. And Gödel, who is one of the unsung heroes of 20th century thinking, mainly because nobody can understand him, including me, secured this as a formal mathematical proof. And so we must live in the light of the fact that we cannot know everything about anything. My brother put this beautifully once when he said, have you ever noticed how as the sphere of understanding expands, the surface area of ignorance grows ever larger?
With all due respect, you just mentioned something I was going to ask you about. Can you, I'm very interested in the work that your brother was doing and what happened with him, and where I could get some information on the work he was doing. Also, does it have any connection with the 19.5 degrees connection north-south on the planetary alignment and hyperdimensional reality? Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. It gives me a chance to pitch my next commercial enterprise, which is Harper in San Francisco will publish a book next year, which I wrote, actually, called True Hallucinations, which will go over and tell the story in rippingly good fictional style of that expedition to the Amazon and the consequences that flowed from it. As to what Dennis is doing these days, he's a drug designer and pharmacologist working for Shaman Pharmaceuticals south of San Francisco. A hellish marriage of commercialism and transcendental concerns. Yeah. The idea of Shaman Pharmaceuticals, Inc. is definitely worth pondering. Yeah.
Terrence, thank you for sharing. And I'd like to say, your role as a cosmic facilitator, your ability to bring people together, I think it's a miracle, the fact that there's hundreds of people here this evening. I think it creates unlimited possibilities for each and every one of us, but I don't think we're really looking at this as an opportunity, and I think it could be. I think there's people here tonight that could be a part of your future, a part of your life, and you may not know it. I was standing at the front door as people were coming in tonight, just watching, you know, the interaction and trying to see how people were dealing with, you know, coming here tonight and listening to you and being a part of it. And I think for the most part, it's very much like the psychedelic experience. It's very personal and it's very private, and you leave here with a sense of maybe better understanding and, you know, a clearer perspective on the way things are. But to really I think, create possibilities is to share amongst ourselves, to introduce yourself to someone, and to exchange information. You know, it's a situation where unless we really are able to network as a team, and I think that's what we are a team, unless we really consider the possibilities and the miracles that not only Terrence creates by sharing, but maybe the miracles that we can create amongst ourselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the major reasons psychedelics are so repressed is so that we will not form a visible community. I mean, this is how homosexuals were suppressed, by making it such an unthinkable lifestyle that if you were one, you dare not speak its name. I'm fond of saying to my audiences, you know, we look pretty much like the rest of society, but you should look around at who's here tonight. Somebody here has what you need, whatever it is. And to the degree that we can make connections, we are more and more powerful. It's literally like coming out of the closet. I mean, you just have to stand up and say, you know, I'm stoned and I'm proud. And what are you going to do about it?
I'd like to be the first one to introduce myself. My name is Harris, and I work in the music industry. I have a company called Organic Entertainment, which was inspired by you. Thank you.
Maybe we should have psychedelic yellow pages, something like that. Thank you.
Hi. I'm about halfway through reading The Maya Factor by Jose Arguelles, and keep reading on because I think maybe if I read one more page, I'll understand what the heck he's talking about. But there seems to be some synchronicity or correlation between what you're talking about as what's coming and between the galactic beam that he's talking about. And I wondered if you could speak to that or if there is a correlation.
Well, I think of that work and work similar as the poetry in anticipation of the millennium. And since I don't think of myself as a poet, I'm trying to really nail it to the wall in a formal way. But there is throughout the present world and for some time many different anticipations of a transformation of the world. I mean, the Hopi have it, the fundamentalist Christians await the second coming, the Shia await the 13th Imam, the Jains are awaiting the coming of the 25th Tirthankara, so forth and so on. This is definitely a time of anticipation of great change. And I think, you know, we all feel it. I mean, you have only to close your eyes or smoke a joint or daydream, and just under the surface is the transcendental object. And it's faceted. And to Jose, it shows one facet. To me, another. To each of us, a unique facet that emotionally resonates with our personality and calls us home. Yes, this is the final time. Anyone who tells you business as usual is a safe bet is going to waste your money.
Okay, thank you. And I have a personal question. It's kind of quick, but are you familiar with the Totonac Indians of Guatemala? Is there
nope
such a thing? Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks.
Write me a letter about them if I should know about them.
Just to elaborate briefly, there was somebody who was studying, it's a brother of a friend who I just found out about, who was studying for his PhD in linguistic anthropology about 18 years ago, and went out to hang out with them and did some kind of ceremony with them where he had some kind of psychedelic that he thought might have been Jimson weed, I don't know, but he'd previously done psychedelics, so evidently it wasn't that kind of experience, but he's never really come back from that. He still hears voices, and it's never been the same. And they are, I was thinking, well, maybe they're Indian voices. So I asked his brother, and he said, no, they're American, they're English, as far as if it's messages that he's... So, you know, they're all pretty much paranoid messages that he gets, and things talking to him. You know, I wondered, maybe some shaman spell was put on him with the psychedelics, or maybe it just touched off something in him that clicked him over. But basically now he's on tranquilizers, so that doesn't help either.
Well, I mean, I would say of that what I sometimes say about channeling, which is, you know, just because somebody's dead doesn't mean they know what they're talking about. So if you have voices, you still have the same obligation to make them make sense that you would if they were sitting in front of you.
So you're saying it's a cop out? Is that what you're...
Well, I'm saying you can't just take it at face value. There's no substitute for discriminating intelligence. You have to bring that to every situation in your life, psychedelic or otherwise. One more question.
Thank you.
Then we're going to have to shut this down.
So, you know,
no, this is blame right. them.
I almost didn't come up here. I heard you talk in 89, and I got up and talked, and I was a little nervous, and I still am. The gentleman, the head of Last Lady, stated that I really felt a need to connect with each other, so at that time I got up and said I would be a focus point. Since then, I published a newsletter. Did you get my newsletter,
mm-hmm,
the link?
Mm-hmm.
I published a newsletter link for the purpose of actually hooking two groups, salon groups and Terrence McKenna's group. And now I've got about 100-150 names, and it really is a mechanism to help us link. So I've set myself up as that focus of people who want to somehow keep connect. The information is on salons. Thank you. On salons and also what's happening. We met four or five times after you talked.
Right.
It was very informative and also very practical.
Well, right. If you'll stand on the steps outside, here is the man in the purple shirt. If you're interested in community and networking, here's an opportunity. If you're not, then you chose to reject it.
Okay.
Thank you all very, very much.